This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're broadcasting today from the Knight Studio at the Newseum, Washington, D.C.'s newest museum devoted to journalism and the news business. John McCain and Barack Obama address the NAACP. Cynthia McKinney goes green, and the clock runs out on Jesse Ventura. It's Wednesday and time for our weekly visit with the political junkie.
There you go again.
You knew that,
when I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
Although we weren't able to shatter that highest, hardest glass ceiling this time, thanks to you, it's got about 18 million cracks in it.
But I'm the decider.
NPR political editor Ken Rudin joins us every Wednesday to talk about the presidential campaign and other political news. This week, McCain and Obama talk about Iraq, Afghanistan, the economy, the Latino vote, and magazine covers. Two Jessies in the news, Ventura, who did not hear from God and will not run for the Senate, and Jackson, who did not know his mic was hot when he suggested surgery of sorts for Barack Obama. A new poll shows Senator Obama with an 8-point lead, but concerns about his experience and some actual votes yesterday in Georgia primaries. A bit later, political put-downs, the barbs and zingers that enliven and sometimes help decide political campaigns. If you've got a favorite, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. But first, political junkie Ken Rudin joins us, as usual, at the Newseum, and we begin with a trivia question. Ken, I just wanted to say that you're no Jack Kennedy.
Thank you. That was an insult, and you're no Ted Koppel. But anyway, we'll talk about that later. Anyway, trivia question this week. Jesse Ventura, the former governor of Minnesota, announced he will not run for the Senate there. That leaves two candidates, most likely the Republican incumbent Norm Coleman and his likely Democratic challenger, Al Franken. Both candidates are Jewish. When was the last time a Senate race featured two Jewish candidates?
So if you think you know the last Senate race to feature two Jewish candidates, the phone number again is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and we'll entertain answers from the audience here at the Newseum as well. And Ken, McCain and Obama making appeals to both African-American and Latino voters. More on the NAACP speeches later today. But McCain held a town hall meeting in New Mexico yesterday to address Latinos. And Obama spoke to a meeting of the National Council of La Raza. Clearly, this is a hugely important constituency.
It is for both candidates, obviously. John McCain has always had this interesting relationship with the Latino voters. First of all, he is one of the few Republicans who have backed President Bush's view on citizenship for Latino, illegal immigration, things like that, the amnesties that some people charge. But, of course, the conservative wing of the Republican Party, that's one of the reasons they don't trust McCain. They feel that he's too soft on this so-called amnesty. So he has this tightrope to walk. He has always done well with Latino voters in his native state of Arizona.
But now says we have to seal the border, control the border before any reform. And, who knows when that's going to happen.
Well, exactly. His focus has changed. I mean, his priorities have changed. He still says he still wants this, you know, this guest worker program. But first things first, seal the border.
And Senator Obama, much better received and, according to the polls, winning 2-1 among Latinos.
Yes. And even though, you know, a lot of people said that because he didn't do well among Latinos when he ran in the primaries against Hillary Clinton, he would have problems with the Latino vote. But that's obviously not the case. Bill Richardson, of course, one of his staunchest supporters. And who knows what a Obama-Richardson ticket would look like. But right now, if you look at the Latino vote of these early polls, still with many months to go, Obama still has a sizable lead.
And still many months to go, but the latest Washington Post ABC poll out today shows Senator Obama with an 8-point lead over Senator McCain, but also a level of concern, interestingly, about both candidates, Obama's experience and other questions about Senator McCain, too.
Right. No, there's no question about that. But remember, the thing we must remember is that this is not a national election. It's a 50-state election plus the District of Columbia. And obviously, the name of the game is not the most votes, as Al Gore learned in 2000, or perhaps Hillary Clinton learned during the primaries, but it's 270 electoral votes. So it's a state-by-state warfare that's going on right now, especially in key states like Michigan, like Ohio, like Florida.
And maybe like Georgia, interestingly, that's usually conceded to the Republicans, I guess since Jimmy Carter ran from Georgia. But nevertheless, it looks like it might be more interesting. And we had actual votes cast yesterday in Georgia, which you found instructive.
Well, it's very interesting. First of all, yes, it's true that that Barack Obama is obviously looking at states in the South that no Democrat has won, well, since Bill Clinton, but especially John Kerry and Al Gore were both shut out of every Southern state. But with large African-American, sizable African-American populations, Barack Obama is looking at states like Virginia, like North Carolina, like Georgia, which had a primary yesterday. And what I thought was interesting about that primary, a bunch of congressional races. And it seemed to be a new generation of black leadership against the old guard, like John Lewis, for example. For the first time in 16 years, John Lewis, who you know was synonymous with civil rights and heroic struggles, and yet he was seen as old news by this new guard of African-American politicians.
Not by the voters, though.
Not by the voters. He got over 60%. He avoided a runoff. He won sizably. But again, there's a lot of that going on. Next month in Michigan, Carolyn Cheeks Kilpatrick, who's the mother of the mayor of Detroit, has two black challengers there. Candidates in New York, a congressman in New York, like Ed Towns, Gregory Meeks.
For Brooklyn, yeah.
Both of whom who endorsed Hillary Clinton over Barack Obama. There is interesting reaction in the black community about this heresy, and so they also have serious challenges.
Interesting that the John Lewis would get two challengers in the Democratic primary, and the Republicans aren't bothering to run anybody against
him. Not in downtown Atlanta. There's no Republican strength. But there's also interesting Tom Barrow, a white conservative Democrat, sizably defeated, easily defeated an African-American challenger. Barrow, a white conservative, was endorsed by Barack Obama. That helped him in the primary. It might not help him in November.
Well, we've got some people who think they know the answer to our trivia question. Again, the last U.S. Senate race that featured two Jewish candidates, and let's see if we can start with Michael. Michael calling us from Berkeley, California.
I'm wondering if it was Barbara Boxer versus Bruce Hershenson here in California.
Well, that was 1978. That did happen, but it was not 90, the... I'm sorry, 1984.
Something like that.
No, 78. It was 1978, but
it was Clinton era.
But it was not the last time. Yes, both Boxer and Bruce Hershenson were Jewish. Not the last time, though.
Nice try, Michael.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go now to, this is Edwina. Edwina from Minneapolis in Minnesota.
That's right. I don't know if this was the last time or not, but it's just amazing that it's happened twice in Minnesota, where we don't have a huge Jewish population, but there was Paul Wellstone and Rudy Boschwitz.
Well, that's not the correct answer. That's true. They are actually the only Jews in Minnesota. But what's fascinating is that both of them were senators at one time. Rudy Boschwitz was defeated by Wellstone in 1990. They had a rematch in 1996, but it was not the last time that two Jews ran.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Edwina.
Bye-bye.
Let's see if we can go now to, if I can find the right button, Judith calling us from Henniker in Minnesota.
Hi.
Hi.
Was it Russ Feingold and Paul Wellstone?
Well, no, actually, they didn't. They never ran against each other.
No, they didn't.
No, they're both they're both Democrats, but both Jewish candidates from. Well, actually, Russ Feingold was from Wisconsin.
I was close.
Yeah, it's close. Yeah, he would have avoided. He would have avoided the two Jews in Minnesota rule.
That's right. That's right.
Exactly. Okay. Thank you.
All right, Judith. Thanks for the try. Well, again, we have a little time left in this segment, so if you think you know the last U.S. Senate race that featured two Jewish candidates, give us a call 800-989-8255.
I can give a hint. Both candidates appeared on Talk of the Nation.
In the same segment.
That's right.
All right. So regular listeners to the Political Junkie segment should know this answer right away. And again, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Mentioning the state of Georgia, a former Democratic congresswoman from the state of Georgia now takes up the banner of the Green Party.
Right. Cynthia McKinney, she was voted out of office in the 2006 primary. She's widely known for two things. One, she socked a security officer in the head with her cell phone because he refused to allow her to go through without showing identification. And she, for the longest time, she suggested that the U.S. knew in advance about the 9/11 attacks, which, of course, caused a lot of derision in the national mainstream press. But she just has a very strong constituency in the Green Party. She's for the impeachment of the president. She blames not only the Republicans for the war, but also Democrat complicity. So she's obviously running against both the Democrats and Republicans. Two third-party candidates from Georgia, Bob Barr, the Libertarian, and now Cynthia McKinney from Georgia, should make that state very interesting.
And, I feel safe in saying I think we can get them on this show.
Why not? I mean, a lot of people say, well, why should we spend time on them because they have no chance of winning? But they do represent a point of view that's out there, and I think one of the things NPR serves is that is the opportunity to have that point of view broadcast.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line for our trivia question. This is Mark, and Mark's with us from New Britain in Connecticut.
Hello there.
Hi there.
I believe I've got it. In the last time Joe Lieberman ran in 2006, the Republican was named Schlesinger. I believe he was Jewish, and they were both running against the anointed Democrat Ned Lamont.
And I believe that is the correct answer.
Hey!
Joe Lieberman, matter of fact, Alan Schlesinger got the lowest percentage of any Republican in the history of Connecticut running for the Senate. Ned Lamont lost the primary to Joe Lieberman, who's now a pro, obviously.
No, Ned Lamont won the primary.
Won the primary, lost the general election, right.
Well, Mark, you get the no prize there in Hardware City.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Before we duck away, a big flap this week over the cover of the New Yorker magazine. And again, if you haven't seen it, Barack Obama dressed in Muslim garb, Michelle Obama looking like Angela Davis, the U.S. flag burning in the fireplace of the White House, where over it there's a portrait of Osama bin Laden.
And some people said that was offensive. No, but actually, look, it was a satire. It was done. You know, New Yorker has done a lot of spoof covers. Of course, this may not have worked. A lot of Obama people are very upset. Even John McCain said it was in poor taste. It was an attempt at satire, obviously ridiculing the so-called arguments, these spurious arguments.
The rumors and lies.
Exactly, against Barack Obama, but it fell flat.
Yeah, it did. And is it possible, do you think? It's so difficult for people to make jokes about Barack Obama.
Well, it's kind of funny. I mean, you know, everybody has a, you know, we joke.
Except for you.
We joked about Bill Clinton and women, and we joked about Hillary Clinton. We're still joking about George W. Bush. There's plenty of jokes about that. But it seems like the Barack Obama candidacy is either very sensitive or the candidate doesn't lend himself to that kind of humor. There's something funny. I hear music.
Yes, How High the Moon.
Then I'm going to stop.
Okay. Ken Rudin will be back with us. You come back, too. We're just going to take a short break. If you'd like to join the conversation, we're going to be reviewing the two candidate speeches to the NAACP and then talking about the great political insults and put-downs of all time. If you've got a favorite, give us a call. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, and we're broadcasting today from the Knight Studio inside the Newseum in Washington, D.C., and you're listening to our Wednesday edition of The Political Junkie. As always, NPR political editor Ken Rudin is with us. In just a moment, we're going to be talking about the candidate's address to the NAACP convention. But, Ken, before the break, you had a funny story about Barack Obama.
Well, it's not a funny story that I've come up with, but Andy Borowitz, who I think is one of the funniest people in the world, a great comedian, he says that, you know, obviously there are not many jokes about Barack Obama, so Barack Obama himself, now this is all tongue-in-cheek, has approved several jokes. And let me just read you two of them. Barack Obama and a kangaroo pull up to a gas station. The gas station attendant takes one look at the kangaroo and says, "You know, we don't get many kangaroos here." Barack Obama replies, "At these prices, I'm not surprised. That's why we need to reduce our dependence on foreign oil." And the other one, a horse walks into a bar. The bartender says, "Why the long face?" Barack Obama says his jockey just lost his health insurance and that should be the right of all Americans. Wacky jokes, huh? They're hysterically funny.
We're just slaying them here. Yeah. The NAACP annual convention is taking place this week in Cincinnati, Ohio. This morning, Senator John McCain addressed its membership at the Duke Energy Center.
So whatever the outcome in November, Senator Obama has achieved a great thing for himself and his country, and I thank him for it. Don't tell him I said this. But he's an impressive fellow in many ways.
Senator John McCain, the prospective Republican presidential nominee who spoke this morning in Cincinnati at the NAACP annual convention. Kelly Brewington, the diversity and demographics reporter for the Baltimore Sun, was there, and she was there when Senator Barack Obama spoke to the convention, and she joins us now by phone from Cincinnati. And Kelly Brewington, nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Thanks for having me.
And give us a sense of how Senator McCain was received today.
You know, it was interesting. People were very polite. They were engaged and excited to see the candidate, but they were not exceptionally enthused by his remarks. He took on an issue that was somewhat unpopular with the NAACP. He talked a lot about school choice and particularly school vouchers. People at the NAACP, from the leadership on down, are not very excited about school vouchers. They don't tend to support the position. So there was only a smattering of applause during his 30-minute speech, but he seemed to make a big effort to connect with the audience afterwards. He did some question and answer and appeared, you know, very at ease and confident, and the audience seemed to appreciate that.
There have been Republican candidates, indeed sitting Republican presidents running for re-election, who did not address the NAACP, and where people did people take note of Senator McCain's effort to show up, and even if he's not going to be necessarily popular, to make an appearance?
Certainly they did, and they noted that. I mean, as you know, the Bush administration for many years, for most of its two terms, did not speak to the organization despite its invitation. And the NAACP had sort of a icy relationship with the administration. Things have thawed a bit. And last year, during its convention in Detroit, the only Republican nominee to address the group was Representative Tom Tancredo. And so they were excited to see McCain. I think his presence made them feel as though he was taking the organization seriously, and their commitment to civil rights was something that was on his agenda.
Ken Rudin?
You know, obviously, everybody at the audience knew that that John McCain initially opposed a holiday for Dr. Martin Luther King. But here's a question I have. Do you suspect that, and a lot of people have suggested this, that perhaps John McCain was not hoping to win African-American votes, especially against a candidate like Barack Obama, but he was trying to appeal to white independents, white moderates, to make the point that he's not as conservative as some make him out to be?
I mean, that could be true. I can't say for certain what his objective was, but it does appear of late, I think this has been said of both candidates, that they've tried to appeal to the middle a bit, if whatever the middle might be, but I guess away from the traditional Democratic-Republican constituents. And so perhaps that was his attempt. I mean, I think he tried to make a lot of overtures at the great work that the NAACP has done. He talked about civil rights and how he appreciated their work for nearly 100 years, and he had, as you played, some, you know, kind remarks about Obama. So perhaps that's his objective. I mean, either way, people seem to appreciate it. Like I said, they didn't agree with what he was saying, but they appreciated, I think, the
I think you were right earlier, Kelly Brewington. You said basically golf claps for Senator McCain, thunderous applause earlier in the week for Barack Obama.
Oh, certainly. I mean, I think Obama's reception was electric. I mean, people waited many hours to pass through a metal detector to get into the ballroom of the Duke Energy Center. They wore buttons with Obama's name on it and T-shirts, and they were standing to their feet shouting in applause during many of his remarks. I mean, there's no doubt that there's a sense of pride that people are feeling here, that Obama's candidacy is, for many of them, a civil rights milestone. Regardless of where they stand politically, that this civil rights sort of, you know, his candidacy represents this civil rights milestone, which is a cause for celebration in their minds.
Kelly Brewington, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Kelly Brewington, diversity and demographics reporter for the Baltimore Sun, with us by phone from the NAACP annual conference in Cincinnati, Ohio. Well, time was the well-timed political insult was part of a politician's stock and trade. The revered figure of Abraham Lincoln, for example, delighted in describing one opponent he can compress the most words into the smallest idea of any man I know. Political zingers stung. And while everybody remembers one or two of Winston Churchill's finest, yes, but I'll be sober in the morning, 21st century politicians are careful to keep their rapier wit sheathed and do battle with powder puffs. Here's a couple of examples of the blunted sword play we've seen this political cycle.
He's very likable. I agree with that. I don't think I'm that bad.
You're likable enough.
Thank you so much.
And after that pillow fight, John McCain's riposte to Mitt Romney in a Republican debate stood out.
I just want to say to Governor Romney, we disagree on a lot of issues, but I agree you are the candidate of change.
These days, a good touche seems to be passé. If you yearn for the crackling political repartee of yesteryear, reminisce with us. Tell us your favorite political jibe, riposte, parry, barb, jab, or flat-out insult. Points for accuracy and for style. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org, and you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. Ken Rudin is still with us. He's NPR's political editor, of course, and our political junkie every Wednesday here on Talk of the Nation. Do you have a particularly favorite political insult?
Well, yes, Neil, I hate your shirt. no, actually, there are two of them I like. We talked about Winston Churchill, and I love this one. When a lady asked her, said that he said, Winston, if you were my husband, I would put poison in your coffee. And Winston Churchill said, if I were your husband, I'd drink it.
That's among the quips collected by Chris Lamb, the editor of Political Insult Compendium, I'll Be Sober in the Morning, Great Political Comebacks, Putdowns, and Riposte. And he joins us now from member station WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio. And nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Look, thank you, Neil. Nice to be here.
And do you agree that the art of the political insult has gone, well, more in the milquetoast direction in recent years?
Well, I think McCain is pretty good at it, and I think he's an exception. But I think what happens now is politicians hire out paid assassins to do their work for them. So I don't think that's nearly as much fun.
And so jibes on the web don't have nearly quite the zing of those ones from the stump.
Oh, it's a lot more fun when they're facing each other in the same room and one says something and then the other one fires back and knocks them senseless.
And do you have, I know you've just run a whole compendium of these, but do you have a particular favorite?
Yeah, my favorite's a few hundred years ago when John Wilkes, a political reformer in Britain, was debating his nemesis John Montague, the fourth Earl of Sandwich. And at one point, they're just screaming back and forth at each other in Parliament. And at one point, Montague says, "You, sir, will either die on the gallows or over the pox." And Wilkes quietly responds, "That depends, sir, on whether I embrace your principles or your mistress."
Good stuff. Good stuff. Let's see. We have some. We have somebody here in the museum who's got some favorites.
I have two. The first is, every time he opens his mouth, the sum total of human knowledge in the world is diminished.
Who was that?
That was from the Ken Burns Congress PBS special.
I don't think that was Ken himself, though.
No, it wasn't Ken.
Okay.
And the other is, nothing brightens a room so much as his leaving.
and about whom was that addressed?
That was about Gordon Brown before he became prime minister.
Ah, well, I'm sure they would say things that are so much nicer now. Your name, sir?
Bill Herzog from Kankakee, Illinois.
Thanks very much for coming to the museum. And are any of those in your compendium, Chris Lamb?
No, they aren't. I'll come out with, I'll still be sober in the afternoon in 4 years and add those.
One of the things that I thought was fascinating in your brief introduction to the book, you say that all of the best political put-downs and snappy comebacks are well rehearsed.
Yes. Yeah. Winston Churchill's line was that all the best off-the-cuff remarks are prepared days beforehand.
One of the most famous ones is the remark that, age was going to be a factor in the 1984 presidential campaign. And Ronald Reagan was asked about that in a debate with his Democratic challenger, Senator Walter Mondale.
"I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit for political purposes my opponent's youth and inexperience."
Which brought down the House. But even as you listened to it, you knew that had been written and rehearsed.
Oh, sure. It was well scripted. And, you know, he knew the question was going to come, but it worked because the age issue went away.
It did. It was defused. Ken?
You know, the same thing with the famous Lloyd Benson about, you know, "You're no Jack Kennedy" line. His aides, following his death, Lloyd Benson's passing, his aides said they worked out, they prepared that for the moment because they knew that Dan Quayle had been comparing himself to Jack Kennedy, that he had the same amount of experience. So that great line, you know, the famous Quayle deer in the headlight look about "You're no Jack Kennedy," that was rehearsed well in advance.
Well, it's interesting. The zingers are rehearsed, but as you say, Quayle looked like a deer caught in the headlights. Yeah. Mondale, at the receiving end of that quip by Reagan, which was really a joke on himself,
That's right.
caught himself laughing hysterically and said afterwards, he knew at that moment he just lost
lost the election.
I think he said that softball, he just hit that right out of the park.
Yeah. Right.
Here's an email from Stanley in St. Louis. A supporter once shouted out, Governor Stevenson, Adlai Stevenson he's talking about, all thinking people are for you. And Adlai Stevenson answered, that's not enough. I need a majority. And that's one of the ones that is collected in your book, isn't it, Chris?
That's right. Yeah, there's a lot of Adlai Stevenson in there. You know, there's a lot of Winston Churchill. There's one Dan Quayle. I mean, Dan Quayle provides the inspiration for the book. It could not be written without him.
You dedicated the book to Dan Quayle.
I did dedicate it to Dan Quayle. He went from a punching bag to a punchline after the line with Benson.
I should say it's printed on potato paper.
How do you spell
yes.
that? You know, one of the famous ones of all time is obviously apocryphal, but it's a 1950 Senate race. Congressman George Smathers of Florida was running against Claude Pepper. Now, everybody called him Red Pepper. Back then, Claude Pepper was very far to the left, backed Henry Wallace in 1948, was really far to the left. So anyway, this was supposed to, allegedly a speech that George Smathers made in rural North Florida, and he talked about how Pepper, now obviously it was supposed to be an unsophisticated crowd in North Florida, so he used all these fancy words. So he said that Pepper was a shameless extrovert who was known to have engaged in nepotism with his sister-in-law, whose sister was once a thespian, and who was acknowledged to have practiced celibacy before his marriage. Now, to his dying day, George Smathers said he never said it. It was just apocryphal. But again, a classic insult, although it never happened.
One of those stories too good to check.
Exactly.
We're talking with NPR's political junkie Ken Rudin and Chris Lamb, the editor of I'll Be Sober in the Morning, Great Political Comebacks Put Down in Riposte. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a caller on the line. This is Dan. Dan with us from Wildwood in Missouri.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
How are you?
Very well, thank
Great
you.
Show. As every Wednesday, I look forward to this. I heard one last week on the Leno show, Dustin Hoffman said that John McCain is so old that he once owned Sidney Poitier.
See, he's not running for office.
Oh, I know that. Your screener pointed that out to me, but I guess it was so good that he had to let it through.
That's a pretty good line. It's a pretty good line. Thanks very much for that. Obviously, not running for office, Chris, that makes a big difference.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think it does. I mean, a lot of these have to do with politics. I mean, that's great inspiration, great fodder, because, you know, politics is a doggy dog world, and we want to make everybody a fire hydrant.
Well, speaking of that, I can't resist the temptation here. Democratic then Democratic presidential challenger, referring to then Republican Vice President Dan Quayle, who had described himself going out on the stump, and he was going to be the pit bull of the campaign.
That's how he characterized himself. He says, "I'm the pit bull dog of this campaign." I told some people here at home that. That's got every fire hydrant in America scared to death.
and that one, well, the guy who got off the good quip actually won that election.
That's right, yeah.
One of my favorites in your book is there are three living former presidents, Jimmy Carter, Gerald Ford, and Richard Nixon, standing side by side at a White House reception during the Reagan administration. Observing the three standing together, Senator Bob Dole said, "Well, there they are. See no evil, hear no evil, and evil."
There was a governor of Massachusetts named Endicott Peabody, and not the smartest guy in the world, shall we say, and his challenger once said that he was named after three cities in Massachusetts, Endicott, Peabody, and Marblehead.
Dawn breaks on Marblehead.
That's right.
Let's get somebody here in the museum.
Barbara Hutzak from Kankakee, Illinois, and my favorite is a description of two presidential candidates, and it is the evil of two lessers.
And who's the author?
It was from a political column 8 years ago.
But it's pretty good stuff.
It was.
We're going to save it up and wait till people forget it, then I'm going to use it as my own. Thanks very much. Appreciate it. As we go ahead, let's see if we can get somebody else here on the line. This is Richard. Richard with us from Shingletown in California. Richard?
Hi, you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Okay, great. Yeah, when I was... not sure exactly when, but Pat Brown and Ronald Reagan, they were running for governor of California. Pat Brown, he was losing and knew it. And so he picks up a young kid and he says, "You know who shot Reagan, don't you? An actor."
Who shot Lincoln, I think, is what you said. But
yeah,
yes.
That's what I said. Yes. Yeah, who shot Lincoln.
An actor. Yeah, it didn't help him, though. It's a good line, but it didn't help him.
Although he was supposed to be a politician's politician, and he'd love to have a little fun with the end there.
Yeah. Ken?
Although when Clint Eastwood was running for mayor of Carmel, California, Ronald Reagan said to him, he says, you know, you have no future in this. You appeared in movies with a chimp. You know, forget about it. You know, so, and you're an actor, so that's not going to work.
Thanks very much for the call, Richard.
All right, you bet.
Coming up, more of your insults, political insults, if you will. Let's get calls in at 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And we're also sharing insults on our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. And, yes, we'll post a picture of Ken Rudin above the insults page. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today, we're wallowing in past political witticisms and coming up with a few new ones of our own, we hope. If you've got a favorite political jab or insult you'd like to share, give us a call at 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Our guests are Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor and our political junkie here every Wednesday, and Chris Lamb, professor of communication at the College of Charleston in South Carolina and editor of the political jibe glossary, I'll Be Sober in the Morning, Great Political Comebacks, Putdowns, and Riposte. Ken, why do you think these sorts of exchange have gotten tamer over the years?
Well, tamer because I think the news has gotten worse. I think the situation, more and more people are unhappy about the situation. I think that, you know, the polls show it. I'm not just jumping on President Bush here, but the last 7 years, if you look at the polls, if you look at the economy, gasoline prices passing $4, reaching $5. And I think that's one of the reasons you don't see that many Barack Obama jokes. I think just people are not in as good mood as he was in the past. And plus the fact that also a lot depends on who's saying the jibe. When Bob Dole, the 1976 vice presidential debate against Walter Mondale, talked about Democrat wars and all the people who died in Democrat wars, that was supposed to be a put-down on Democrats, but it backfired because it was so seen as mean-spirited. And when Reagan, as you said earlier, when Reagan made that comment about Walter Mondale in 84 about his opponent's youth and inexperience, it really was a self-deprecating thing about his own age, advanced age. So I think it depends on the kind of way. If you say it with a smile, it works. When you say it with an angry tone, I think it backfires.
And Chris, it does seem to be helped to be British.
It does help to be British, yeah. But I think they're sort of trained that way. I mean, in Parliament, they do fire back and forth at each other, and that's not the way things tend to work in America. But getting back to Ken's point, I think it's very successful to be self-deprecating. Lincoln was sort of the master at that. One time, an opponent called him two-faced, and Lincoln responded by saying, I leave it to my audience. If I had another face, would I wear this one?
Yes. Now, let's see if we can get a comment from here in the audience at the museum.
Hi, my name is Arlene Dunn. I'm from La Crosse, Indiana. And this insult would elicit more of a groan than perhaps laughter. But after Barack Obama won the North Carolina primary, Bill Clinton said, well, Jesse Jackson won the North Carolina primary in 1988. I found that pretty insulting.
Mm-hmm.
It was South Carolina, but yes, absolutely.
South Carolina,
I mean,
right.
I think the point is Bill Clinton tried to diminish the fact that the magnitude of Obama's victory, and by dismissing it, well, you know, any black can win it there. After all, Jesse Jackson won it. It clearly backfired. My favorite South Carolina put down, though, is 1986 when Fritz Hollings was running for re-election, and everybody was talking about drug testing at the time, and his Republican opponent said, I challenge Fritz Hollings to a drug test. And Fritz Stalling said, well, I'll agree to that if my opponent will take an IQ test.
thanks very much for that. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And let's go to Stuart. And Stuart's with us from Easton in Pennsylvania.
Hi, Stuart Brody from Easton, Pennsylvania.
Hi.
The best political jab that I remember was from the 1992 election. That was when George Bush Sr., talking about Bill Clinton, basically said, we don't need Carter II. I think the reason why it sticks out of my memory is that it was just so cheap. It was such a cheap shot. It wasn't even funny.
Funny this time when Barack Obama says John McCain would be a third term of George Bush? It's the same joke.
The thing with Barack Obama's comment, it's a little closer to the truth.
Ah, I see. All right, I guess perspective matters a lot. Thanks very much for the
although
call.
When William Henry Harrison said, we don't need Timbuktu,
the same kind of deal.
Not as funny, though, not as clever.
Not
nearly as clever.
No, not anymore. Let's go to Joe. Joe's with us from Baton Rouge in Louisiana.
Yes, I don't remember who it was that said it, but in the lead-up to World War II, somebody was quoted as saying, if it's war, Eleanor, by God, give me war.
If it's war or Eleanor, speaking of the president's then-wife, or then-president's wife, Eleanor Roosevelt.
Correct.
Again, not one of those zingers that went down in history, I guess.
I guess not.
Okay. Thanks very much.
But going back to 1992, when the Republicans criticized, now Bill Clinton had been the governor of Arkansas and Al Gore was just, you know, a freshman or first-term senator, the Republicans said that the only foreign policy experience that Bill Clinton had was when they had breakfast once at the International House of Pancakes.
Pat Buchanan's line, I think that was.
Well, maybe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
But I wanted to ask you, you have, Chris, a bunch of quotes from Winston Churchill in this book, and regrettably not my favorite, or actually, I'm pleased, because then I can tell you the joke. And the fact of the matter is, I've never checked it to find out if it's true, because, well, it's a really good story that during the Casablanca conference, Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt are there. And for the first time, FDR got to meet Charles de Gaulle, the Free French leader who'd been a thorn in Churchill's side for any number of years already. And after the meeting, de Gaulle leaves the room and Churchill goes in to see President Roosevelt. And Roosevelt looks at him and says, my God, he really does think he's Joan of Arc, doesn't he? And Churchill replied, yes, and my generals won't let me burn him. How closely do you check good stories like that?
I don't.
Good for you.
We were speaking about apocryphal stories back in 1948. One of my favorites was the Thomas Dewey, who everyone thought would be the next president, including Thomas Dewey. And the day of the election, he turns to his wife and he says, tomorrow night, how's it going to feel to go to bed with the man who's going to be president for the next 4 years? Well, out the Dewey's way, and the next morning, the Deweys are at breakfast, and he's crestfallen, the worst day of his life. And as a wonderful wife she is, she sidles up next to him and says, "Well, Tom, is Harry Truman coming over here tonight, or am I going over to his house?"
There's another one along those lines from the famous senator from Maine, Margaret Chase Smith, asked once what she would do if she woke up in the White House one morning.
Oh, is that for me?
That was for you. That was a setup.
Oh, I'm sorry. I would wake up, apologize profusely, and leave at once.
Apologize to the president's wife, I think.
Exactly,
yes.
Right.
This is from Susan emailing us from Media, Pennsylvania. This was a self-deprecating comment made, to the best of my information, by former Chief of Staff John Sununu. When asked why people take an instant dislike to him, Sununu responded, "It saves time." Let's see if we can get Shay on the line. Shay's with us from Salt Lake City in Utah.
I really like the one that Mike Huckabee did recently on Mitt Romney when he was like, people want the guy that they work with, not the guy that they laid off. I thought that was a good one.
That's not a bad line. And Mike Huckabee, that campaign, Chris, they seem to have a lot of good one-liners.
Yeah, I think you mentioned Al Franken, a comedian running for running for Senate, and Mike Huckabee seems to be a politician running for comedian. So everything's all mixed up nowadays.
Shay,
but a good insult. Yeah, I think a good insult in this campaign was another McCain-Romney, where after Romney attacked him, McCain said, "Never wrestle with a pig. You get dirty, and the pig likes it."
Here's an email from Kevin, one from James Reston regarding Richard Nixon. He inherited some good instincts from his Quaker forebears, but by diligent hard work, he overcame them. And you don't think of Richard Nixon as you know, just a bucket of yucks, necessarily. But there is one really good one from Nixon in your book. After hearing John Kennedy's inaugural address in 1961, Richard Nixon, who had narrowly lost to Kennedy, bumped into Ted Sorensen, one of JFK's speechwriters, and said, "I wish I had said some of those things." "What part?" Sorensen says. "The part about ask not what your country can do for you?" "No," Nixon replied. "The part that starts, I do solemnly swear."
Well, that was the line they asked President Eisenhower about Vice President Nixon, and they asked him if he could. A reporter asked him to say how Nixon his contributions during his 8 years as vice president. And Eisenhower said something like, well, if you gave me a week or two, I could think of something.
You always love it when your political mentor stands right behind you 1,000%. Let's see if we get Leilani on the line. Leilani is calling us from, is this Moline, Illinois?
It's Mundelein.
Mundelein. Okay, I didn't believe it. I thought it was Moline misspelled.
Well, there you go. Named after an Archbishop Mundelein.
Okay.
So there. This is Dean Acheson on Dwight Eisenhower. I doubt very much of a man whose main literary interests were in works by Mr. Zane Grey, admirable as they may be, is particularly equipped to be the chief executive of this country, particularly where Indian affairs are concerned.
That's a good one. That's a good one.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Leilani. I appreciate that. Timing is everything, and also where and to whom you deliver the barb is everything. But a lot of the liners in this book, Chris Lamb, seem to be, somebody's press agent told somebody else, and that's how they get around.
Yeah, I think that's very common, but, you know, they still make good stories. You know, I hate to, you know, I don't want to get the facts to get in the way of a good story. There was a story this campaign, remember when Lynn Cheney, Vice President Cheney's wife, you know, kept telling, on an interview, kept saying how Dick Cheney was related to Barack Obama. And they asked Barack Obama about this. It's seven generations they were related, and they asked Barack Obama how it felt to be related to Dick Cheney. And he says, well, every family has a black sheep.
We're talking with Chris Lamb, who's the editor of I'll Be Sober in the Morning, Great Political Comebacks, Put Down, and Riposte. Of course, our political junkie Ken Rudin is with us, as he is every Wednesday here at the Newseum. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. Let's get Katie on the line, and Katie's with us from Jackson, Mississippi.
Hello.
Hi, Katie. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Well, I had one from the Democratic debate this primary season, and it was during the controversy when Barack Obama was copying some speeches by other politicians, and Hillary Clinton said, that's not a change you can believe in, that's a change you can Xerox.
That's not bad.
Yeah. I liked it. He didn't get a good reception, but I thought it was pretty funny.
It was pretty funny, but she didn't win.
No.
Although, just for the record, though, her supporters still hope to put her in nomination at the Denver convention, and some of them are still expecting a roll call vote that could put her over the top over Barack Obama. You know, we talk about, this is just changing the subject for 1 second, but how Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama made their peace in Unity, New Hampshire, but obviously their supporters have yet to do that.
And yet they've discovered a broad Egyptian river flowing through Denver, Colorado. Denial.
Yeah, queen of denial, right.
That's right. How can you forget, this is an email from Jory in Evanston, Illinois, how can you forget Joe Biden's a noun, a verb, and 911 describing Rudy Giuliani?
Right.
That was a pretty good line this time around. This from Eric in Oklahoma, not really political, but one of my favorites is that George Bernard Shaw allegedly sent 2 theater tickets to Winston Churchill with the note, here are 2 tickets to opening night, come and bring a friend if you have one, to which Churchill replied, cannot attend opening night, will come second night if you have one. He also notes, I have somewhere a copy of The Wit and Wisdom of Spiro Agnew, all blank pages. As you go through these, I wonder, Chris Lamb, mark politicians as promising for future editions of this book? I mean, are you hoping that Mike Huckabee, for example, stays on the national political stage?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I look at politics differently from Ken does. I'm in politics for the laughs. I think Huckabee will stay around. I think McCain's pretty good. McCain can be in future editions. I don't know who else.
But everybody tries to, you know, run and stuff a sock in his mouth before he says something outrageous. He does another bomb-eran.
Yeah.
And he also says
I know, but I find that honest. I mean, I would rather have the guy who's capable of being funny than someone who isn't.
Ken?
Well, I was just thinking of the other comment that John McCain said about when it was found out that the largest export of the U.S. to Iran is cigarettes. And he said, well, hopefully more Iranians will smoke them and more will die. It was kind of, And so sometimes your quick wit can get you in trouble. Mike Huckabee, when he was at...
Never happened to you, did it?
No, I don't have a quick wit. But but when Mike Huckabee was at the NRA convention and he heard some loud noise in the background, and I think there was he made some kind of a joke about a shot taken at Barack Obama... in jest. Now, the thought of that as being a joke, so that one of the reasons Mike Huckabee will not be on a Republican ticket is that tendency to speak off the, you know, off the cuff and get yourself in trouble.
Let's go to David. David's with us from Muncie in Indiana.
It's probably apocryphal, but Margaret Thatcher apparently having dinner with her cabinet was asked what she'd like to eat, and she said, I'll have the steak. And they said, and for the vegetables? And she said, they will have the steak also.
That actually does, Chris Lamb, sound a lot like Margaret Thatcher.
Yes, it does.
Thanks very much for the call, David.
You know the soundbite we played earlier, and I don't think the audience understood, but when John McCain said that to Mitt Romney, yes, you are the candidate of change, it was because everybody was talking about Mitt Romney's flip-flops on abortion and stem cells. So he said, yes, you certainly are the candidate of change. That's right. What that was from.
In 1928, Ron emails us, Al Smith, New York Sen or Gov, he asks, ran against Herbert Hoover for president. A heckler yelled at Mr. Smith, tell them all you know, it won't take long, Mr. Smith replied. I'll tell them what we both know, and it won't take any longer. A lot of these are genuine, seemingly, ripostes to hecklers, Chris Lamb.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. You deflect an attack. One time, Lincoln was giving a speech, and a man stood up and said, I can't believe I paid a quarter to see one of the ugliest men in America. And Lincoln paused, and he said, it's true, you paid a quarter to see one of the ugliest men in America, but I got that same privilege for free.
Let's get Andy on the line. Andy with us from St. Paul in Minnesota.
Good afternoon. One of my favorites comes from Teddy Roosevelt, and he was speaking of Taft when he said, he means well, but he means well feebly.
That's good stuff. A lot of the lines from here's another one from Theodore Roosevelt. A friend visiting President Theodore Roosevelt in the White House, T.R.'s young daughter Alice, kept pestering the Mr. President. The friend complained, isn't there anything you can do to control Alice? Roosevelt replied, I can do one of two things. I can be President of the United States, or I can control Alice. I cannot possibly do both.
I have one of Churchill, if I'm with you.
You're still with us. Go ahead, please.
I would be surprised if this isn't in the book, but Churchill once listened to a gentleman give a speech. I believe it was in the House of Commons, and he came outside, and a reporter asked him afterwards what he thought of the speech. And Churchill said, well, the man spoke without a note and nearly without a point.
That's not in the book. You're getting a lot of material here for your next book, Chris Lamb.
I am. Thank you. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
I also, if there's time, do have the best joke, I think, that ever came out of a presidential campaign, and it's one that the Jackson folks came up with about themselves.
And you've got 10 seconds.
Oh, I can't do it in 10 seconds.
Well, then you're going to have to wait for the next edition of Chris Lamb's book, where undoubtedly you'll find it.
Excellent. Thank you
very much for the phone call. Appreciate it. And Chris Lamb, thank you for your time today.
Okay, thank you, Neil.
Chris Lamb's book is I'll Be Sober in the Morning, Great Political Comebacks, Put Down and Ripostes. And also with us, of course, Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor. Thank you, Ken.
See you, Neil.
I'm Neil Conan, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.